Well, good morning, actually. Good afternoon, everyone. It is Wednesday, October the 22nd. This is episode 3751 of the Survival Podcast. And I've got a banger for you today. We're kind of doing a two-parter in one episode. We're going to talk about two things today, the rise of global digital ID and the real threat that it represents. And we're also going to be talking about surveillance in the school systems. And we'll be doing that with our special guest, Hakeem Anwar, who is the founder of Above Agency, manufacturers of the Above phone, the Above tablet, and the Above book. Great tools for your privacy and many other things they provide, like information about the type of things we're going to talk about today and things that you can do both with their products and for yourself to protect your privacy and your identity. Whenever Above phone is a sponsor of the day, I always point out that the world we live in, like the people that make your software, your applications on your devices, they're spying on you. Your ISP spies on you. The device maker itself spies on you. Literally everybody that touches anything spies on you. And the people that don't directly spy on you, if they want your data, they just buy it from one of the people that do, including the United States government, which most of the people will just give the government the data because that makes the government leave them alone so that they can do what they're doing. And it's way worse than that. Hakeem is on today to tell us all about that and what we can do in response to it. Before we get into it, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day today, which we will begin with JM Bullion. I am a huge Bitcoin bull. It is where I put the vast majority of anything that I would call surplus capital that I'm wanting to grow for more than a couple years. However, I still stack silver and gold, and if I need to add to my stack, I still go to JM Bullion because they've been sponsoring the show since 2012. That's forever in the world of podcasting. They give a discount on purchases to MSB members. They ship all orders free, and they have better pricing than the big silver houses like Lear Capital and Monex and Atmex. And I can also talk to the president of the company anytime I want if there's any kind of a problem, though I haven't had to do it for that reason in a very, very, very long time. But the fact that I can is really important to me in taking care of my audience. You should be stacking silver and gold. If you paid attention to what's been happening to the price lately, there is a reason. And I think we're in an irreversible trend at this point, at least long term. Next up today, it isn't gold, but sometimes it sure tastes like it's gold. Of course, I'm talking about Biltong, the South African whey from Anton's Biltong USA. Great company, great owner. I've met Anton in person many times. He's a wonderful, wonderful person. He's kind of the guy that's on our side, too. I mean, like many people that come from countries that have already advanced into full police state mode, like South Africa, when he comes to the United States, he realized how close we were to being in the same place. This guy is kind of a warrior for liberty. He also makes some of the most delicious Biltong, Drewers, and other products that you'll ever find at BiltongUSA.com. And MSB members, you guys get a discount as well. With that, let's go ahead and get our special guest on with us today, Hakeem Anwar of Above Agency. Hakeem, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jack. It's good to be here. Hello to everyone listening.
You've been on the show quite a few times, actually. But, you know, not everybody has seen those episodes, so some people don't know who you are, what you're all about. Before we dig into the topics today, can we kind of dig into who is Hakeem? Like, how did you end up in the space that you're ending up in today with Above? Like, before you were doing this, what did you do in life, and how'd you end up here? It's not many kids that are, like, playing in the sandbox or hanging out in study hall in high school even and saying, hey, I'm going to grow up and found a company to provide digital privacy.
Yeah, I didn't know I was going to do this either, but thankfully I was a black sheep. You know, I was awake for a very long time since college. Luckily, I had the right people around me to be like, yo, here's what the military-industrial complex is doing. And that kind of left me seeing the illusion of working in the corporate space. So I never really fit in there. But I was a software engineer. I built web and mobile applications. I worked for really big billion-dollar companies. And I also consulted for really small ones. So I was kind of able to get the total picture, get my fingers in a lot of different technologies. And at the end of the day, I realized, like, hey, we could do better. We can do better than these big companies are, how they're serving, you know, how they're serving the people. And also to build products that mean more. And so in 2019, I met Derek Rose, who you may have had on at some point, and we worked on the Freedom Cell Network together. So I helped build that website, and I was like, wait a minute, this is the true power of technology is bringing people together under one cause to get shit done. And mm-hmm. so since then, I've just been working on solutions. I have a blog. It's called Take Back Our Tech. I teach people how to de-Google their phone and to use Linux and what the migration is like. And then I also have Above, which is our privacy products company. I've been doing both of these things for 4 to 5 years now. And yeah, it's just been really successful. We do laptops, phones. We have a private cellular service. So yeah, a lot of different things.
What I've got you on to talk to about today, like we said, it's kind of like a twofer sandwich here. We're going to start off with digital ID. It's kind of the thing, just it exists and it's mandatory in China to exist, to have digital ID to get anything done. The EU seems to be rolling it out very rapidly. To me, you don't have to take on my personal opinion, but I feel like the EU is turning into the fascist dictatorship that we're accused of being under the Orange Man really, really fast. Like, I think there was over 12,000 arrests in the UK alone for social media posts. In the last year, right?
I've seen some of those videos. Yeah, it's just crazy, right? That they could come to your door and just pull you out of your house for something you said online.
And I've actually heard people make excuses like, well, most of them aren't actually prosecuted, as though that makes it okay for like police to come to your door and put you in jail even overnight for something. That's an intimidation tactic, even when they drop the eventual charges. But there's been a few thousand charged there and actually given like multi-year sentences over a social media post. And so the EU collectively is saying, hey, yeah, we're going to do digital ID, man, but it's like for everybody's convenience and to help out with a lot of things, but it will never be mandatory. Do you believe them when they say that?
No, I don't. And you know what the EU specializes in? They specialize in bureaucracy and bureaucracy and bullshit. I was just in the EU, actually, and so I got to see it firsthand. I got to talk to some people on the ground, and not everyone wants it there. There's actually a lot of rogue kind of communities in Austria and in Italy that are pushing back, but a lot of people are going along with it. And because it's convenient, right? And so they say that, hey, this framework for the EU's digital identity wallet called eIDAS is going to be voluntary. That's actually written into the law, is that you can't be denied any rights for not having one of these wallets. You know who else also had these same things written into law? Well, India. And the Supreme Court even ruled specifically and said, you can't be denied rights if you don't have Aadhaar, which is India's electronic ID. And what ended up happening? Corporations did it anyways, and they couldn't fine every single corporation. Then people started to do it to each other, which I think is like the dark. That's when you know your digital ID program is complete, when people start imposing it on each other. Yeah. So I think it could easily become mandatory. I call it mandatory by proxy, and we'll see that. You see that in some of the countries in the EU, like Estonia and Denmark, where you need digital ID to open a bank account or to buy a piece of property or to buy a car. So it's coming really fast in the EU for sure.
I mean, that is the way that you do it, right? You know, by proxy thing. But we didn't say you had to have one. Like, if you don't get one, no one's going to come to your house and drag you out and scan your face with a boot in the back of your neck and make you have one. But, you know, we can't help it if the, you know, grocery store won't take your credit card without your digital ID. That's their purview.
That's their private choice. That's their freedom.
That's private choice. And yet, you know, we do it now for the airplane, if you want to get it on an airplane. But that's really, you know, the carriers wanted that. And, you know, like, and eventually, like, okay, you don't have to have one, but you can't do anything. You can't, like you said, open a bank account. Well, that, you know, the banks are independent businesses who say that that's what they require of you, to open a bank account in the EU. And then it becomes a de facto mandatory thing. You can't function without it. I had somebody today point out, like, he says, libertarians like you, you willingly register your cars, but then you say you won't register your guns. You need to be consistent. It's one or the other. Like, well, first of all, let me tell you, I don't think we should have to register our cars. But we do, because I can't drive the car on the road without it. I can carry my gun and not tell you I have it. I can, maybe I shouldn't do that, but I can. Right. I have no choice when it comes to, if I want to be mobile in the United States of America, I need a car. The minute I pull it out on the road, if I pull some sovereign citizen nonsense and write up my own license plate, I'm getting pulled over and going to the clink. So is it mandatory that I register my car? Absolutely, it's not. You know, you don't have to register a car. You don't have to have a driver's license. You can buy a car. If you have, like, a great big 500-acre property, you can drive that car anywhere you want, never register it. But yeah. You want to do, like, you see what I'm saying? Like, do you want to actually function in society? Well, you got to do it.
There's also, you know, because I've got friends who have just made their own plates too. And I say that's extreme. I say that maybe in natural law somewhere you could get away with it, but it's, am I willing to go through the inconvenience of going through jail and like fighting it? Cause I'm not well educated enough. Maybe some other people are, but yeah, like people need to draw their line in the sand. This thing that we're experiencing with cars and with guns, it's going to come to digital ID. Like this is happening, you know, whether you like it or not. And the institutions will have to go up against, or one is the government. Sure, the government services will be behind a wall. So things like Social Security for, you know, for U.S. citizens. I'm not saying this is going to happen tomorrow, but in the next 3 years, it's very, very likely. Like programs like these exist in 90% of the world. Like these wallets are going to be available within 2 years or less. The U.S. is eventually going to get on board. And there's a lot of evidence to show that really this, the U.S. is the center of digital ID development. But anyway, so there's social services like Social Security, EBT and food stamps, which is shut down anyways, right? There's going to get your driver's license, and that's already a thing. You know, there's 5 states that require biometrics for you to renew your driver's license. And Texas is one of them, Jack, because I think that's where you're around. And so then it brings you into question like, all right, am I going to enroll in the digital ID, or am I going to be illegal with an expired ID? And I think it's a question that everyone should be asking themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I'd want you to kind of talk about what is, you know, who's pushing the agenda, because there is a lot, and this isn't really so much a digital ID system, but like I just became aware there is a surveillance system, for instance, in Prague, Czechoslovakia, called VERA. And it was completely funded by the United States. Like we put it, there isn't a city in the world apparently where you're more likely to be on a camera at any point you're outside than Prague, Czechoslovakia. For whatever reason, we chose to do that there. And you said we're pushing the digital ID, but we're kind of lagging behind the rest of the world and having it. So is that what's going on? Is it our CIA, our NSA, et cetera, like developing all the tech and then distributing it?
I'm glad you brought that up. I was just near Prague, believe it or not. I was in the Czech Republic like a few weeks ago. The smaller towns, they don't have that system. But like what you pointed out, right, let's make the distinction between the surveillance grid and the control grid. The surveillance grid is being rolled out. You know, it's the CCTV cameras. China and Russia are really far ahead. They've got cameras everywhere. The control grid is the formalized infrastructure that ties your legal identity with your biometrics. So that's kind of the definition of a digital ID. Right. It's a part of this larger concept called digital public infrastructure, which comes from the United Nations Development Program. And so what the UNDP is doing is, you know, their thought leaders, obviously they collaborate with the World Bank. So any country that has a relationship with the World Bank is being prodded to do identity projects. Like, for instance, Nigeria got a $430 million grant / loan to build an identification system. And so there's some of these poorer countries are working on things just like there's literally people going into these rural villages, walking around with a biometric camera and a computer. And that's all they need. They're really well funded. They spend millions of dollars to go and get everyone registered because those are large and documented populations. Now, the United States, our government doesn't have that problem. More people are already registered, and the people who aren't undocumented are getting kicked out of the country. And so we're a lot farther along. So the only piece the United States is really missing is the biometrics, which is where going into, you know, your Department of Motor Vehicles and renewing your ID, if you see a camera there that says IDemia, you're basically submitting to digital ID, right? Once you give up your biometrics and attach it with your legal identity, it's done. That's like provable if it can be used in these legal frameworks, right, to control you. And at that certain point, it doesn't matter anymore. You don't need to download an app. As soon as they have your biometrics and legal identity, they can create the digital identity for you, and they can keep it on their server. Doesn't matter if you use it or not. It will just still be tied to future actions. And when they do finally release the app, which in the United States we have mobile driving licenses, right? Those are like the Google and Apple IDs that you can get that are accepted by the TSA. That is also digital identity. So if you enroll in one of these two systems, you've already gone into it. And when more of the control part, right, we're in the carrot part right now where they kind of have to make it sexy and convenient. When we get to the stick part, you don't need to do anything. You're already in it. And I can talk about what the stick part looks like in Russia and China. It's pretty nuts.
I kind of feel like in some ways there's not much you can do to prevent this, because most people are already, like you were just saying, have a digital ID. As far as your biometrics, okay, you walk into a bank, they know who you are. There's a camera there. Like I was in the military, so my fingerprints have been in the system since I was 17 years old. There's a legit reason you'd want to do that for someone in the military, because if somebody dies on a battlefield and there's pieces and parts and you find a hand, you can identify them. But there's also, like, that just means the federal government has that information. It's probably the case that I don't care whether you get a real ID or not, because that's just about the documentation you give the DMV. When you renew your driver's license, boom, there you are. There's probably not a person out there that the government can't just stick your name and your maybe your social security number, last four in, and boom, there's the digital ID of you, again, whether you're carrying it or not. So is there anything that even can be done about this other than being like the off-grid type, you know, Unabomber in a shack somewhere?
There's some solutions right now, and they're kind of obvious when you think about them. But let's just assume that the biggest cities they're going to implement some of this digital ID stuff. I live near a digital city. I live near a big city. I've seen firsthand accounts of these new IDemia cameras in this city, and then you know there's places like California, Texas, Illinois where these are already part of the DMV. My thought is if they're rolling this technology out, fine. I'm going to do my driver's license renewals way farther out in the country. And there is a bit of a difference between just a picture someone takes of you and a biometric face print, right? Because there's point mapping, there's depth sensing, like the different parts of your face. There are also those aspects that the face print cameras can do a better job of. So there's a little bit of a difference. But yes, yeah, so it's going farther out in the country. If you are traveling even to the EU, which I left one day before the biometric travel requirements. Is there a way to get around that? I don't know, but you would probably have a better chance going through the smallest airports. Like, you know, I was in Italy. I've seen some of the airports there. They're tiny, right? I really doubt it. So there's a little bit of a window where you've got flexibility, but it's going to close soon. So you just kind of need to make sure you're set and you're anchored to where you are.
Yeah. That just means, well, good luck traveling then, because like I can tell you right now what they're doing in the airports. You go in and you travel, you hand them your ID or your passport. They have you stand in front of the camera, and that is supposedly to make sure you are who you say you are and it matches your passport or some bullshit, which, come on, I don't believe that for a minute. You're right into a database right there. I mean, I don't think there is such a thing as out of the database anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think about. One, you can opt out at the ID checkpoints at the airport, right? You just say, I don't want to do the picture. If you're coming in back into the country, sometimes CBP gives you a hard time. But definitely domestically, you can just be like, nah, I don't want to do that. And I think that's what people need to continue doing. It's an interesting concept, though, to say that you're not in a database. I think where the distinction is when you combine your legal identity with biometrics that can be used in a court of law, and there has to be legal precedent to set that up. I'll give you an example. It's like there's cameras everywhere, right? They're not going to bother by trying to identify and match up people with their legal identities based off of street cameras. But if you come into a government appointment and here's all these identification cards and here's also your identity, that is a much stronger proof of identity, right? So I think they look for strong proofs of identities. I'll give you an example in Russia, where Russia was, they mandated, I think it was like in 2015, I want to say, that banks would start to do KYC requirements and do facial scans. And what they expected was that they would go into the national system, that banks would just hand their data over. And in typical Russian fashion, they had a little fee to use the national system. So banks were like, why the hell would we send you our facial scans when you're going to charge us money? They just did it and they kept it privately. Mm-hmm. And so they wisened up recently, and I think it was in 2024, they started saying, no, you need to use the national system now. And so the stuff that you went through in the bank, boom, now is accessible by the FSB. And that has turned into today, you're walking around on the Moscow metro, the CCTV camera scans your face, matches it with a face print, and pulls up your legal identity, and then you can be detained. They're currently using this to find people who are trying to dodge the draft, which is insane, right? When you get a, and this is happening through their digital ID system too, which is called Goslugi. But if you're chosen for the draft, you get a notification. You have about 20 days to respond. If you don't respond, you can't leave the country, which I'm sure as soon as you got the notification, you're screwed anyways. You can't leave the country. You can't get a job. You can't open a business. And they'll stop you on the metro. Dude, that's insane.
Yeah. So, yeah. But I mean, like, I just don't know if there's any way. Like, okay, you're out of the country. You have a passport. That's federal identification. That's why, like, when they were talking about the whole, you know, the change with flying, you have to have a real ID or they won't let you on a plane. Well, yeah, I had a lot of people, I'm not going to get a real ID. Do you have a passport? Yeah, then you have a real ID. I mean, isn't that also the database? When we got our passports, you had to do fingerprints. There was a bunch of shit to it.
Yeah, you definitely had to do fingerprints for the passport. I don't know if they took a face print. So like a lot of, you know, so I've studied like every program throughout the world, and they're every continent throughout the world, and there's different types of biometrics, right? The face print is a really important one, and one I think that, I mean, most programs are now starting to use that today, but I think there's a lot of people who don't have their face prints recorded, like in a legal formal setting. I think more people have their fingerprints recorded, but I don't think people have their face prints recorded, and I would just say I would try and avoid it at all possible costs.
Because you have a Facebook page, though? Do you have, you know what I mean? Like, you're right now on video with me. Like, if some government agency wants to match you to something, it's, you know, not hard to do. And your passport is in their database. Like, I'm not trying to poke holes in here. I'm just looking at reality. Like, is there really a way out of this?
No, I hear you. And I'm just going to say one more thing. And you know this as well as I do. The government is lazy. And it's not a very formal system to like try and investigate and find people's videos, right? You still need like the formal legal precedent for it. And that's why, you know, the World Bank is spending, like, that's why these are all government-led programs. That's why they're giving billions of dollars to countries in South America and Africa. Now, I'm not saying what you're saying is wrong. I'm just saying that they're going to take a different approach to do it, to have an actual control grid. They need that, right? Mm-hmm. So hearing what you're saying, I'd say, yes, online privacy is hard, and they could, technically, they can scan your face and some individual or investigator body could probably match your identity, but are they going to use that as the basis for digital identity? Probably not. I don't think they're going to do that. And right now, what the option is we need to avoid biometrics at all costs. We should avoid using the digital ID system at all costs. We should avoid using Google Pay and Apple Pay, which will eventually turn into the digital ID apps for the U.S. So I'm just trying to raise awareness of that, because sometimes you can be enrolled in the system without thinking about it, right? From what I've heard at the driving license offices, these cameras don't look any different. Like, the only reason you can even spot them is because they say IDEMIA on the side. Mm-hmm. So it's insidious, right? They want you to do this. They don't mention to you, yeah, you're going to have to renew your ID with biometrics, but it's happening. It's under the surface. So if they are trying to trick me into something, I'm just going to do the opposite.
Okay. What countries right now is it mandatory, even if it's not mandatory? Like, yeah, if you don't do it, they'll come get you. But like, you just can't exist without it.
Yeah, that's a good question. There's Estonia and Denmark in the EU, which are they're just I think it's like Denmark is 96% of the population is registered on it. And so Denmark has already also done the other parts of it, which is like the digital payments. And once you have the digital identity with the digital payments, it sucks because you try, you know, you go against the government or you do something wrong or you even fail to pay your taxes, they literally can shut off your account. And what Denmark realized was, hey, our system's not very secure. They got DDoSed in 2022, and it shut mobile banking down for the whole country. So people couldn't use their banking app. Yeah. Whoops. Yeah. That's the system they built. In India, India is similar. Aadhaar, it's used everywhere. Similarly, they have a, you know, surprisingly, people like to, I'd say India has its fair share of failures when it comes to this technology, but everyone is really praising the UPI, which is their unified payments interface. And it's a super fast digital payments transaction system. It does something like 7,000 transactions per second on average. So all of India is already using that, right? So that's like, that's digital public infrastructure. Jack, you know, digital ID is just the first piece. They have that. They start to do digital payments, and then they do the data exchange, which is a good example of that is companies like Brazil, countries like Brazil, which they have started to store their digital identity on a blockchain. More than that, they have 6 different offices that store information associated with the digital identity. We're talking like tax information, your financial transactions, property information, so travel information, right? So you're starting to see this data exchange part. When all those triangles are set, boom, there's a control grid. So we're kind of early on, you know, we're well into digital ID, but if we can try and curb it at digital ID, we can at least protect ourselves that way before the DPI increases to all these things.
I think there's a lot of things to worry about. Like, I look at it and say, well, like where I live, there will not be surveillance cameras where I live because it's not economically viable for even a government the size of ours to do it. We're too spread out, you know, I'm 20 minutes away from Fort Worth where it would be everywhere. But you'd say, okay, well, if you live further out, like you can just live your whole life. They don't know where you're going. Well, they're going to tie it to your car. They're going to tie it to your car. Every time you have a handoff on a cellular tower, you know, they know who owns the car unless you're taking some countermeasures like, you know, your device. Even with a device like from a mobile phone, there's still some things with that. You know, you have to have tags on your car. We talked about that. So they send you your renewals. There's an RFID chip in there. If you have a toll tag, there's an RFID chip there. The cars are probably going to be mandated to put some sort of signal in them that tells them where you are at all times because we're going to autonomous vehicles. So you have to do it anyway. Like, and then what I also thought of is like the facial recognition. There are countermeasures you can take physically that disrupt those cameras where they can't tell who you are. And it's not necessarily wearing a Barney mask or some shit. Like there's things that a person walking by you would notice you're doing, but the camera then can't identify you. However, the same can be said as license plates. So there were people that were putting these screens on their plates to defeat cameras. And then the cops started pulling those people over specifically because there was only so many, there's only a few of them.
Yeah.
Right. And because what they were, to be fair, what they were mostly doing with them here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, they were hauling ass down the tollways with no toll tag. When they switched over to sending your bill to your house based on your plate, and that's what their reasoning was. But it also showed that if you're taking those countermeasures, you stick out as this one in this giant group that can't be identified. So therefore, you need to be investigated. So I just wonder how this is all going to play out.
Yeah, that's definitely interesting to think about. You reminded me that there is, it's in the registration sticker, right? The RFID chip.
Yeah.
So it's the one on your windshield. Yeah. Yep. So I mean, there are these other ways to track you, and there are countermeasures, but they're also always like working past those countermeasures. So it looks like some of those things you can do to subvert digital ID is the face paint, the mask doesn't, you know, the mask. Why would you want to wear a mask in the first place? That would suck.
Yeah.
There's different things you could do to play around with it. But yeah, it's always this cat and mouse game. And I do think for me specifically, it's going to be a little bit like Minority Report, right? It's like eventually there's going to be this digital fracturing of society, this physical and digital fracturing, where there's an in-group with privileges and there's an out-group who have a better life, even though they don't have those same privileges. And so my hope is that we start to show up on these systems less registered, right? There's less information on us. Because when you do have that digital ID as a foundation, then you could start adding more information onto it. Like anytime you purchase something, anytime you buy a ticket, you go to the stadium, you're traveling, it all starts to be added onto the digital identity. And I think what governments are realizing, they have like way too much data to even try and handle. That's why companies like Palantir exist, right? They're trying to make it easier. But these organizations, think about the people who who end up being career government officials, right? They're just normal people. So they also need really smart ways to integrate this data together. So the digital ID is meant to be interoperable and do that. I'm not saying that, you know, simply avoiding biometrics is going to keep you away from the surveillance grid, but it will protect you from the control grid. And I try to make that distinction.
Okay. Because I think my concern is, yes, I agree, humans are slow, but computers are fast. And, you know, with a lot of the AI components that are being integrated now, it would be easy to give an AI agent a task like, go find all of these things that are missing a face to go with it and put them together. And that's scary for two reasons. One, it makes them more efficient, which we're depending on their inefficiency. But two, that also opens up a cascade of potential errors of mismatches. I mean, we've already had people on a no-fly list that can't get on a plane. It turns out it's an 11-year-old kid, but he had the same surname as the person that actually was on the no-fly list. And that's human incompetence. Mm. I certainly believe computers... I mean, ask GPT a complex math problem, and it'll give you five different answers five different times. Yeah. When you tell it it's wrong, when it's right, it'll believe that it's wrong. So it is capable of error, but also capable of doing the thing.
Yeah, I agree with you. And think about this, too. It's like, what happens when you get your digital identity stolen?
Yeah.
That's not something you could be like, change my social or whatever. It's like, that's there. Like, that's forever. Boom. And you know, it happens. So, I mean, that's like another reason to maybe not do that. In Singapore, they've had digital ID for a few years. They have this app called SingPass to do the biometric verification. If you go on the dark web, you can buy SingPass accounts. There's like 3,000 of them available, and people, you know, criminals, cyber criminals buy them to run other scams. But yeah, that's also an interesting to think about. It's like, all right, there's things that you can protect with your credit if you get your like legal identity stolen or whatever. But what happens when it's your like biometric identity? And also with digital ID, when some of these systems are like younger and they're not super robust, there's privacy features that they can implement. They always talk about the privacy features that it can have and why they do it, but they don't ever say that they're actually going to do it, nor is there a way to verify it. So when it comes time in the future, you see people using digital IDs, they're scanning it at the grocery store, know that grocery store could literally turn around and impersonate that person. So think twice about scanning that digital ID, right? You could literally just copy it, say, I'm this person now. And just go.
Yeah, that is the biggest scary thing to me. And like, you know, I don't even want to set up things like, you know, kind of like an Apple Pay or something like that, because then if somebody gets your phone, they have access to your bank account, and you can say anything you want about passwords, but you know how that works, especially once you have the device in hand. I think it's funny whenever the FBI seizes a phone and they make a big deal out of telling Apple, you need to crack this for us, as though they really can't get into an Apple iPhone, you know. Like,
it's totally marketing. It's marketing.
Yeah, it's to make you think you're more secure than you are. Now, we said there's countries where digital ID is mandatory. Are there any that it's really not mandatory? Not just making the way we say, but it kind of feels that way?
Yeah, did you...
Did I lose you?
I didn't hear the last question. Did you ask if there was countries where it's not mandatory at all?
It's not mandatory, but it feels mandatory. Like, if you were living there, there might not be any real absolute need to have it, but you feel like you have to have it. Like, just to fit in society?
There's a ton, you know, like in Africa, there is the Ghana card, which Africa is doing something interesting, dude. They're creating an interoperable group of states like the West African bloc, where in Africa, they don't have phones, right? So they're like, okay, let's go lower tech. They have electronic ID cards tied with biometrics, and you need it to open a business and to drive in the country, right? So Ghana is the place where it's like, okay, 18 million Ghanaians use it, which is the majority of the population. Like I try in this report, which by the way, you can go to abovephone.com/digital. It's a 33-page report. You can download the report there. You can see I've been really clear. I want people to have a clear definition and understanding of what these things are, because if you just don't know what they are and you're just scared, then that's not productive, because you start to see a boogeyman like that's digital ID, that's digital ID, and you don't actually know what's going on. So mm-hmm. I tried to create a definition for it. And so there's places like Ghana. There's also places like Uruguay, which is a World Bank funded digital ID program and they're kind of also trying to do the same thing, but there's different levels of trust. It's needed to get social services and all that. There's also places like Pakistan where you need your electronic ID, which is called Nadra, to get even a cell phone number. It's tied with your actual registration number, right? And mm-hmm. so like this legal distinction I think is important, Jack. I know it's really hard to escape your face being scanned everywhere, but I think the legal distinction is important, because that's when government can start to abuse it. So what happened in Pakistan when they tied legal identity to the mobile phone service after the previous prime minister, Imran Khan, he was like the people's favorite, right? There was like these huge rallies all across Pakistan. They had to shut down the internet to stop people from talking about Imran Khan and going to these protests, right? So the next administration decided to go back in time and say, all right, who was around these protests at that part in time? All right, let's look in Islamabad. And they found the phones, they found the phone numbers, bloop, they found the legal identities, and then they canceled those people's bank accounts. And some of them were like, I didn't go to that protest, I just live nearby, right? So it's just like, it's just random. It's random. And that's, you know, some crazy stuff that can happen. But Pakistan's another place where you need it everywhere.
That's, you know, the phone thing, though, that's an issue. I have a family member who's a sheriff's deputy that was attached to an FBI task force. Mm-hmm. And he originally did that because he was working on a task force countering human trafficking. And he's pretty libertarian for a sheriff's deputy, man. Like, but that was like, if I catch somebody doing that, I don't care where they go. I'll throw them in a wood chipper. So federal prison's easy button. But once you are in something like that, then they can move you. And he ended up moved onto a task force attached to January 6th. And they were literally interviewing like grandmothers and shit because their phone pinged near the Capitol on January 6th. And I'm like, how do you even do something like that, dude? And he said, we're really good at not being good at our job when we need to not be good at our job. But that was like an intentional thing that he and his group decided, like, we're not going to go out of our way to arrest some freaking soccer mom here.
Yeah.
But there were other people that clearly didn't take that approach. So that's just even like that's a good reason to own a device like you market.
Yeah, no, the January 6th thing, you know, they have the cell towers, but from what I understand, you know, and I don't have any inside information, your family member knows better, but they also use Google's system, right, which is Google's location system, which is available on any Google phone. If you use a Google phone, you're being added to the system, which is called Sensor Vault. And what it makes, what it enables law enforcement or government or any organization that has that access, and it lets them draw a picture on the map, and they can pick in a date and time, and they just see whichever phones pop up in that area. Guys, it's anonymous, but it's not really, because it's trivial to just request that additional information from Google. So like right now, the best thing that people can be doing is to use a phone that's completely cut off from Google services. It's completely cut off from Apple services. like the above phone, which I've got up right here. And let me just show you, kind of see up here, I've got the airplane mode on. If you're going to go to a protest, one, make sure you have a de-googled phone, because at least that way the code is transparent. You know that the radio's not going to be on when you have airplane mode on. So have that. The second thing is, put it on when you go to a protest. And so it's changing a little bit. I think the paradigm is changing for what people use cell service for. I encourage people to use internet-based communications. Jack, you're aware of a lot of those, like Noster is, a form of internet communication. Video calls, like Jitsi, is a form of internet communication. And it can replace phones. It's just kind of a social effort. We need to get people to stop using phone numbers and to use it. So there are all those types of solutions on here. This is our video conferencing solution called Jitsi, which you can see. It's just a link and you can join anywhere. And then you can just send that link to someone. And now you'll be communicating over the internet, which is protected by law, right? That's you can encrypt that. Whereas cellular communications, you can't encrypt. In fact, it needs to be, warrantable.
I was trying to give you center stage there with your thing, but let me try.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, there it goes. You can hear me, but now they just see you. Go ahead.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So yeah, there's different solutions to communicate, and I'll keep it short because I know we got other stuff to talk about, right? So there's internet-based communications. So you could see that these are encrypted messages I have with some of these people. this is a messaging protocol called XMPP. Think WhatsApp or think Telegram, but private. Why is it private? Well, one, because it's completely open source. You can see the code. Two, you can run it for yourself. So, at TSP, Jack always is talking about self-sufficiency. This is the closest thing you can get to self-sufficiency in your communications. You could run the server yourself. And so it lets you send encrypted messages, voice calls, and video calls. And it also lets you integrate a phone number, which is really, really cool. See, so if I go to Bob Smith here, you kind of see something that looks like a phone number here. So it can actually bridge out to the phone network. But you don't need a SIM card. You just need to be connected to the internet. You could do it by Wi-Fi or you could do it by wire, and you could still make phone calls. So that's improving your privacy. Now, it's not the cell towers that are tracking you, but when you're making these communications, it's actually encrypted, and it's only trackable when it actually goes on to the phone network. So it's improving your privacy that way. And what's really cool about it, too, is that so you can do international texts, you can do international calls, you can do group texts. And this is what the texting looks like. So I can just use my voice keyboard here and I can just let him know, hey, Bob, I bought this new service with Bitcoin. Send a message out to him. And it messed the last part of that message up. But it's usually, it's very, very solid. So, the best part about it, this service that I'm talking about is only $5 a month, right? So why wouldn't you want that? To improve your privacy and to pay less to your phone provider and to not give any personal information, which you don't when you sign up for this thing.
I have a lot of people that cause me some technical issues because they're not sophisticated enough to use StreamYard. You're the only one that occasionally causes a little bit of a tweak because you're too sophisticated. That's a good thing, though. Anyway, that's fine. Whatever you want to put up, I'll work it out. No, I want to kind of move on toward the school surveillance because, to me, we can fight all we want. I feel like the person that's 15 right now, by the time they're your age, let alone mine, they won't even care. And part of that is not just surveilling them in school because that gives them a lot of information about the parents as well, but conditioning to them to expect it. So there's something that seems like it makes sense, and I've always said that things like textbooks still being in print in 2020 is stupid. However, when the school starts providing the devices, that opens up a whole new level of, surveillance potential. So I like the electronic book concept. I think you could give a kid a login and it could be all cloud-based and they don't need a device. They could use any device. Like, I don't know what you're on right now, but I'm betting it's not what I'm on, and yet we're using the same you know, browser-based platform. So there's ways around that. But once the kid has a device, that you give the kid the kid takes the device home, carries it in school, uses it for all their work, they're very surveillable. Here's my question. Where'd they get the money for it? Because schools are always saying they don't have money, but yet they have, like most schools now have this policy.
I remember breaking my back with like six textbooks in it. Those were the days, you know. You're holding that on your back. It was good for you. But things have changed nowadays. Like there's like 96% of schools have Chromebooks, these little Chromebooks inside of them. And where'd they get the money? You know, it used to be a trope that like teachers were poor. I think it probably still is, but not to that same degree. And schools could barely afford like desks and stuff. So what changed? Well, the pandemic changed everything. COVID-1984. So I don't know if many people know this, but the government gave schools $184 billion, and this was from 2020 to 2024, September 2024. They only had one rule. It did not matter what they spent it on at all. They just said you have to spend it, you have to allocate it by September 2024. So imagine going from being a poor school that doesn't really you don't have all that much money to have yeah, exactly. You buy a lot of Chromebooks. So, for instance, they're very private about these. They're private contracts. You can only get see little bits and pieces here, but every year there's millions of Chromebooks purchased. Texas put $200 million in total towards devices and also to buy homes without internet access, and they had so much money still left over. They needed something to spend it on. So this whole educational technology industry formed overnight, and the whole focus was on let's make sure these kids learn their best and they're not distracted. And so what did that translate into? Surveillance. Surveillance so that they could see what was going on any kid's screen at any time. And this didn't stop in the classroom. It could also be performed at home. So there's 1,700 different companies that do this. There's a smaller number of big players. But I started to interview these kids because they really inspired me. This group of kids were kind of sick of their Chromebook, and they're now college aged, but they decided to hack their Chromebook.
We lost you, man. I don't know if you hear me. I don't hear you at all. You're locked up hard.
Am I back?
You are now. You keep like locking up. You're locked up right now, if you can hear me. When you unfreeze, let's have you bounce and come back in. That might help with the connection because you're completely locked up right now. I don't believe it's the government, because if the government did it, exactly, they would get me too. Why don't you try bouncing out and coming back in?
It's probably someone using the internet downstairs. I'll be just give me 1 second.
All right. Somebody's probably streaming like freaking 10 movies at once in his office or some shit. So we'll just give him a break and I'll edit this out of the audio only side.
All right. We've got a whole production line going downstairs. So I think sometimes we can step on each other's toes. Yeah. That should be better now. So what was I talking about? I was talking about inspired by these kids. And so Jack, yeah, you know, like on a conceptual level, getting electronic.
You definitely were locked up when you were saying they hacked their Chromebooks. We don't know what they hacked them to do.
Okay, good. So like these Chromebooks, they were just pissed off because they were super locked down. You couldn't do anything except for the authorized apps. All the websites were blocked, and they were just tired of being treated like children, because I think children are the youngest generation, even children is demeaning. They're really capable of a lot. So if you treat them like they're kind of like idiots and you have to work inside of this box, those are the type of people you're going to get. And that might be why they're designed that way, right? So they they jail jailbroke them so they could install any operating system on them. And they installed Linux, of course, and they started using that. And they were able to. But they were telling me that it's only a very small group of kids that are doing this. All of the other kids, they're kind of just accepted that that is the norm, that the teacher can spy on them at any time and watch what they're doing. It's like a panopticon. You don't know if they're watching or not. And they've just kind of accepted it. And what does that do? Well, this is the next generation of people. So these young people are going to grow up into, citizens that are behaving the same way. Who cares? They've already been used to the surveillance. And that's what I think is the big kind of agenda behind all of this tracking in schools.
And for people that don't realize how that can go so wrong so fast, this isn't even about the devices themselves. This is like during the initial school shutdowns during COVID. There were things that would happen, like a kid logs into a Zoom meeting for school, and there's a BB gun on the wall in the back of his bedroom, and next thing you know, the police are knocking on the door doing a child welfare check because the teacher called and said the kid had a gun during school.
That's so crazy.
You're dealing with people that I believe this. I know I always get teachers pissed off at me. There's some really great teachers and all. There's also some people teaching our kids that have an IQ of about 76. And then they're also like uber liberal nut jobs with an IQ of 76, because that's a phone call that should have never happened. And if you were concerned at all, that should have at least warranted a call to a parent first. And so every time that kid sits down to do their schoolwork and opens it up, it's not just about what that kid's doing and who's sitting in front of the screen. It's everything in the shot of the camera behind them could be scrutinized by some person that really doesn't have any business knowing anything.
Yeah, you're totally right. And if there are teachers listening to this, you know, when did teaching just become a profession where you just sit on your laptop and you're like, here's the lesson plan for today, and you literally don't talk to kids? Because from what I hear, that's what most school classrooms are like today. And that's a really sad state of things. Like, that doesn't seem like a proper education. So I would say that we need to recognize that children are capable of a lot more, and that they actually become better at problem solving when you give them more options. So I think we need more independent thinkers. And then also some of like the capabilities of this surveillance technology are really, really gross. For one, they are a lot of these, you know, students. This is their personal laptop or tablet. They take it home. They've got their whole personal life on there too. They're on TikTok. They're on Discord. You know, all the things that they like to do. All of this activity is being monitored, and they're actually in some school districts, they're being added to special lists. So, for instance, if they talk about self-harm, which this is something that kids like to say nowadays, KYS, kill yourself, that they get flagged. They get flagged as potentially suicidal, right? So then it goes up the chain. So it's this crazy, like prison experiment happening at school. And so they get put on these lists, which I think is very, very gross and wrong. And then there's also these things like in some schools, if you take a bathroom break, you're supposed to take your laptop with you, and it's tracking your location, and it detects how long you're in the bathroom for. So if you're fooling around for more than 10 minutes, you get a detention. No shit. Mm. Like, that's actually what happens in some schools. So it's it's just another case for homeschooling or what do you call it, like Montessori's or private schools. We need more solutions in that, because these schools just have way too much money now, and they're just forgetting the whole reason. And there's people smarter than I, like Richard Grove, who've gone into the Prussian education system. It's mm-hmm. meant to make them more obedient workers. So this is just taking them to the final step.
Yeah, and you're not wrong about the way teachers are teaching today. There was a guy, this is pre-COVID, so this is like 18, 19, somewhere in that range. And he told me he's a tech, an AV tech, and one of the company's big customers is a school district in West Virginia. And he goes into this classroom, they have these giant, like 70-inch plasma screens with the kids' lessons on it. And pretty much all the teacher does is push a button, play a video. And she said, "Oh, thank God you're here. I can't even teach without this." And he's like, "Well, what the hell do we need you for?" Just like, why do we need somebody with a degree in education if that's the case? Like, you could take some, you know, any random retard that's not a threat to the children that can push a button on and off, click a button that says grade, and they could be a teacher. Why do we need a degree professional? If they, like, it's basically daycare with electronics.
I mean, they're just an electronic administrator. That's what they've been reduced to now.
Daycare, which is sad. AV. It's AV-based daycare. That's all that it is, you know. And it happens to be somewhat educational, the AV part of it, maybe. That's debatable in itself, you know.
And here's another thing I've been thinking about, Jack. It's because I've started looking at the work of another very accomplished Jack like yourself, Dr. Jack Cruz, and he talks about the blue light conspiracy and how the frequencies, the peaks of the blue light that is coming off from our screens is generally, it's been designed to make you more suggestible and to make you more docile. So now imagine kids are already in front of screens 8 hours a day before they go home. You know what that is doing. And I've been becoming more aware of this. I've been going out and sitting in the sun. I already feel a lot better. But there is a huge amount of the younger generation that this is all they do all the time. So that's the most dangerous thing, I think, out of everything. And that's the only argument I would make to having like physical textbooks. I'd kind of agree to. I'd be cool with like a tablet that's just no light coming at all from the screen. They have those e-ink readers now. I think that would be cool as well, but it's just something for parents to think about.
And they have blue light screen protectors, which I use. I wear glasses that are actually blue light blocking glasses. There you go. Mine just look like mine are regular prescription everyday glasses and do the same thing. The problem for me is I can't do it with a screen because I'm farsighted, right, or nearsighted. So if I put my glasses on when I'm close to the screen, I can't see. So I have to use some sort of a filter. But yeah, you're right. We can get into new monitors that don't do that. But I'm with you on the blue light thing. I'm not big on conspiracies. People think I am because I'm open to them. That doesn't mean I'm big on them, right? But I also believe that sometimes a thing happens by happenstance and then, well, let's run with it. Like maybe you didn't know it when you did it, but once you figured it out, like let's go all in on it now, that type of thing. Like I don't necessarily think the first time somebody thought about putting fluoride in water, they thought about it making people passive. But when it did, that's not a problem now, is it?
They discovered that in Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
Right. And yeah, it's like usually they learn from each other. He's got this good interview where he talks about, the Allies were curious. All right, why are you putting fluoride in the water of these camps? And they're like, oh, it makes them more docile, easy to work with. And they're like, huh. And that was the start of the fluoridation program. Similarly, with this light, there was a doctor, what was his name? Robert Becker. He wrote The Body Electric. And he was the one to first warn the government about the effect, how important like electromagnetic energy and light was and the effects that it was having to the military and people around these equipment. And they kind of got that research, and that might have been the spark of the idea, although I'm not an expert in this. But
yeah,
I tend to agree with you. But, you know, like to assume, like, let's say that blue light is the problem, like we're in a whole world of mess. And that goes for anyone who's on the computer nowadays. I think that's everyone.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the fluorescent lighting in a lot of offices and schools too. Anyway, where do you think the agenda on the school surveillance has its genesis? I think there's just a lot of suspects. Like the teachers unions alone are just, to me, some of the biggest scum on the earth. Then you've got the government's got their paws in it, the state, the local, and the federal level. But to me, I look more like to the technocrats on this. Like, I think there's a whole technocracy that just sees the government as another lever that they can use to get what they want.
You'd be making a very good guess. Yeah, no, that's right. Ironically, it somehow involves Jeffrey Epstein, because of course it's a small network at the top. So like what I tried to look at was this whole one device per child thing that mm-hmm. most states are doing. They say, hey, we're going to have one device per child. So I was like, okay, when did this program start? So the first program in the U.S. was in Maine, Governor Angus King, and they gave 80,000 devices to their students. And then he says he was inspired by this other guy named Seymour Papert, who's a computer scientist at MIT Media Lab. Okay. MIT Media Lab, funded by Jeffrey Epstein. Mm. But also, this guy is interesting because he had an international organization that was going out to Africa with one laptop per child, and they were like, here you go, learn. And boom.
There you go, learn. All right. Learn.
Just learn, kids, and it was a failure. It was a failure, but he got funding from the United Nations Development Program. He spoke at the World Economic Forum. You know, it was a whole startup thing. So that's where some of these ideas are coming from, right? This program that's in every state is one that's very aligned with the World Economic Forum. And it's like in actual real world studies, or like with this one device per child program, it doesn't help at all with learning. It's not cost effective either. So this is a way to embezzle our tax dollars, because remember the $180 billion, it's government funding that's coming from our pockets. It's not very cost effective. A library could do better. And without a lot of support and ongoing maintenance and costs for running these software services, these programs would fail, right? But I think it's just they've created the problem, and then they also have the solution, because nowadays, you know, kids have a lot of learning disabilities. It's hard for them to see. It's hard for them to read. And so that's kind of their case. Say, hey, here's a device. Here's a Chromebook. It already does all of that. It has all the accessibility features. You can translate it into many languages. And I think that probably I'm starting to feel this way too, is that there needs to be a space carved out in our life, especially when it comes to our kids, at least to a certain age, where there's just like no tech. And I'm saying that as a CEO of a technology company, and it's just too crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like we've taken the best pull technology ever and turned it into pull and surveillance technology. And what I mean by that is, if you really want to create a learning environment, the internet might be the greatest thing that's ever been developed if it was used as a pull device. In other words, when I want to know a thing, I can find a thing that I want to know. And that is an incredible thing. But if I can then use it to shove data into you and make you believe what I want you to believe, and you know, reverse the stream, so to say, which is the goal of all marketing on the internet, is to turn it into something that the person feels like they're pulling, but it's actually being pushed out, because that makes them more receptive to it. So by using electronic education, I can either create the most dynamic, tuned into the individual education ever created, but instead I'm creating the most uniform, centrally controlled form of education that's ever been created.
Yeah, absolutely. And with AI, now it's being centralized even more. And, you know, I the U.S. is inspired by China's AI plan, and they say that AI is going to play a major role in every form of education, in every form of work, right? So if that's the direction we're going, this AI is going to be fed on a bunch of small sources. It'll just be sad, because people will start to lose the ability to think for themselves. But just think about how much more valuable that makes someone off the grid who can think for themselves and who knows how to research. I agree with you, Jack, too. I'm super aligned. Even when it comes to AI, too, it's a tool. Mm-hmm. And you know, this report, I did a report on like almost the entire world's digital ID programs. I don't think I would have been able to do it without AI, but I had very clear boundaries of what it would help me do and what it wouldn't. It could help me research. I would go through every single link and read about it and come up with my own thoughts and conclusions. And there's kind of this interesting relationship that happens. But when you start to just outsource everything to it, that like a lot of lazy people have, which just makes me sick because it's ruined the internet. You know, that's you're doing yourself a disservice there.
Yeah. What are we going to get above AI, man?
Well, it's
Wow, did I just hit on something? You got all him and a haw there.
We got something cooking. You know, we want to support the projects that are out there. Actually, Jack, I'd love to put you. I mean, you already know Mike Adams, right? He's got his new AI, and we're going to have a special version of our phones that is going to carry his AI. It can run on our phones and laptops. It's great. It's local. So we'll be doing that soon. So if you guys are interested in an AI-enabled phone or laptop, definitely check us out. Jack, do you mind if I share your screen? Share the screen for
Go ahead.
All right, let's put this up.
Let's see if I can get you on. Let me get you up there. Just give me a second. I'm going to try to make it where it's you, not me, that is the individual. So you have, yeah, there you go.
Okay, cool. And then I've also got the share screen there. Cool. So yeah, this AI solution we're going to build. Well, Mike has already been training. Like he's told me it's just a crazy number of books. And Jack, I'd love to connect you with him. Maybe you can learn about it too. And I'm sure you guys would have a lot in common because it's trained on a lot of survival books. Actually, that would be good. I would love if you actually asked it a bunch of questions. It's available for download. I'll bring it up in a second. But, what I wanted to share with the audience is if you go to abovephone.com/TSP, you'll be signed up. There's a webinar here. We're going to do kind of just an overview of everything you need to know right now in the privacy landscape. I will tell you exactly how the big tech phones are spying on you. So it's not just some black box. It won't be a mystery. You'll know exactly how it works. And then I'll show you what life is like on an above phone, like what the migration is like, right? How you're going to stay in touch with people, how you're going to do your office work, how you're going to use your crypto. We're going to look at all these things. And so it's just kind of like an explain everything overview. So if you go to abovephone.com/TSP, it'll be on there. Look for Rise Above Device and Ecosystem Overview. It's right here. We also have, if you want to get the digital ID report, it's up here, which when you click on this, yeah, you'll be taken to that page. So yeah, those are the two things. This is coming up October 29th at 12 p.m., so I'd love to see you there. After that day, we're going to have a Black Friday sale, so definitely be tuned into the page. We're going to have a really, really awesome deal on phones and laptops and free services, so stay in touch. And then for the AI, if anyone is interested, which, Jack, I would definitely love for you to interview this AI, right? Yeah. And give you really just critique it. So they've got a survival coach. So I'd be interested, right? So this is Enoch. Mike has trained it on like thousands of gigabytes of different books, many from the old world. He's trained it on Green Med Info. He's trained it on the Alex Jones Show, for better or worse. And so it just knows a lot about a lot. And so you can chat with it online, and then you can also download the Google file. So it's like a 7 gigabyte file, and you can run this on your computer at home or your phone. Even when we have these Brightian Edition Above phones, we'll send out an announcement, and you'll be able to get an Above phone or Above book with it already built in it. And it's super cool. You can chat with it. It's not extremely fast, but it's definitely doable. It's not as fast as ChatGPT or anything, but yeah. The best part is, you know, you ask it about a sore throat. Instead of telling you about a pharmaceutical, it'll recommend something like elderberry syrup. And that's why we use it, you know.
Well, let's pull this back into talking about the schools here. You kind of mentioned already they got a ton of money to do all of this with. But how are the schools spying on their students? I'm betting it's more than just what we saw during COVID with a phone call or two because somebody was concerned about a background.
Yeah, well, I mean, so anything that's happening on the Chromebooks. So there's the first, the Chromebooks are a really important part of it. I say the Chromebooks, there's some schools that have other devices, but it's like 96% Chromebooks, right? So anything they do on this device is tracked and logged, including social media accounts. As soon as they log into TikTok, now the school has that information. And what some schools have been doing is now they just look at the social media profile to see what that student is doing. which I think is just the result of having too much money. when you have too much money, you totally just start wasting your time with some of these things. And so they're tracking them, what they're doing on social media. They're tracking them at what they're doing at home, and they're tracking them at what they're doing in the classroom. And like I mentioned earlier, based on what they're doing on social media, they'll put them in different lists. The one that was controversial was like they detected that if a student was wanting to be a different gender, or if they were gay or something, and they would add them to that list. And so that was controversial. And then they would treat, you know, they would set up counselor appointments with that student just to make sure they had all the support they need for the students that were, you know, supposedly suicidal, which could be on anything. They would pay attention to those, and they would try and get in between that. And if you say anything wrong on your chat room, God forbid, if you joke around about hurting someone or even just kind of playing with that idea, you know they're on top of you, right? So the detention, like, the works. So they have this surveillance grid, and it's about $60 billion, $40 to $60 billion that is going towards these educational technology companies, which have built this surveillance grid for the students.
Well, and you know, they always sell these things, these Orwellian things, with good intention, vibes anyway. I'm not saying that they have a good intention, but they use what sounds like a good intention. Like what they would say to you is, well, hey, you know, we might prevent the next school shooting.
Right.
Because, yeah, you know, this guy will tell his friends that he's going to do it, and we'll, you know, intercept him before. But somehow that never happens. That that person always ends up and goes and does what they're going to do. But then if you say, like, you know, you shouldn't be doing this, that's what they'll say. Oh, well, so you're for kids getting killed. You're for children hanging themselves. Look how many kids killed themselves. They won't take any responsibility. Why are so many young people in our school system killing themselves? No, let's not talk about that, but we could have prevented it if you privacy crazy libertarians didn't get in the way. That's always how this is presented.
It's a hard one to argue against, right? But I think you nailed it. It's like, well, why don't you take a deeper look at what your schools are like and how kids really feel about what you're teaching them and their outlook on life, right? You're not challenging them. You're not exposing them to anything new. You're treating them all as if they were robots. They don't get to go outside anymore. Like, of course, no wonder they're suicidal. So I think it is really, we are really calling for the next generation of education to come out. And I think that's private schools. My plan is to have kids the next 5 years. And, you know, that's the timeline or whatever. And they're not going to be in school. I also don't know if I want to purely homeschool them, because they're probably going to get annoyed of me. Mm. So we need a better solution, right? I think we should, you know, we should try and develop that together. Do you have any solutions on that front, Jack? What has your local community been doing?
So we have had our grandchildren in homeschool through a company called Acelus for years, and they just actually went back to public school. I'm not exactly in love with it, but they're my grandchildren, not my kids, so it's not my choice, and it was the kids' choice. That worked out really well, and we would connect with other homeschoolers for activities, and that was really, really useful. I don't have a good answer to this, because the reality is so much money is being stolen to fund these school systems that money that you could use to educate your child, you're out of pocket to property taxes. And if people are like, I'm getting around it because I'm renting. No, you're not. I've been a landlord. If you don't think my property taxes are a line item in your rent, then, you know, you're wrong there. It's a very difficult thing. And when you look at, like, I think you're in Texas too, aren't you? Are you down by Austin?
The southern United States.
Okay. All right, we'll leave it at that. But if you're in Texas and you look around at the schools, the amount of money being spent on the school's infrastructure, I'm talking like stadiums that these kids play sports in. That's why my grandson wanted to go back. He wanted to play competitive baseball at a 6A level. So that's why he wanted to go back. He was very athletics driven. And I look at these parents and I understand what they're saying. They're like, you know, I'm paying $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 a year in property tax. And there's this giant, beautiful school with a football stadium that looks like it belongs at Notre Dame.
Yeah.
And I'm going to take my kid and have my wife not work and homeschool him. It's a very difficult, challenging situation to be in. I've encouraged it as much as I can, but I cannot fault the parent that says I can't do it, or, you know, I want a career or whatever it is. I'm really not sure what the answer is there, other than we need to teach children how to learn instead of teach them things. In other words, we need to empower. I think we need more and more kind of like self-developed coursework that is, here's how you develop your own self-directed learning plan. Because that's what school used to be. Like, if you go back 100 years, 120, 130 years, a kid that came out of high school level was way more educated than today, but there was a lot of things we didn't teach. We taught, you know, reading, writing, math, basic history, and basic science. That was pretty much it, because the concept was, if the person had that, if you can do grammar, logic, and rhetoric, then you have the tools available to learn anything you want to learn. And when we were getting ready to start homeschooling, my wife was really nervous about it, and we talked to a couple that were part of our community named the Breeze family, and Sue, the wife in that marriage, said, you know, she told me, talking to my wife, she said, don't worry about it. You cannot make a child learn something they don't want to learn. And you can never prevent a child from learning something they've decided they want to learn. Wow. And it was the second part of that that hit me like a truck, and going, yeah, that was true about me in the 80s. I didn't have a magic box with all the answers in the universe, and we still figured out everything. We learned how to make a firecracker out of strike anywhere matches and a bicycle spoke. All right. If you can do that in the 1980s, imagine what you can do as a 15-year-old today. If you simply understand, like, the problem, I think, with an internet native is they don't understand and respect the power that they have. They have no idea what they've been handed. Like, you were born into this world where every answer you ever wanted was there, and you can't be bothered to do it. You're more concerned about being a 16-year-old simp with an AI girlfriend. Like, we need to break. Right. That's what we need to break for these kids. Like, make them understand you have a fucking superpower in front of you right now called the internet and AI. I don't hate AI. I just think that it can be used against us, right? But you can also use it. The problem I have with AI is the same thing with the internet. You have to know enough to know when you're being bullshitted.
Right. Yeah.
You have to develop enough wisdom to access the knowledge responsibly, if that makes sense.
You have to know what you want. And I mean, I think you nailed it. And I think that there could be different stages, which make a lot of sense on the health aspect and also on like a development aspect. It's kind of what you were saying. You know, you grew up without these technological tools and you were better for it. And then when you had them, you skyrocketed, right? Mm-hmm. So if at early ages you just kind of raise them on books and stuff without the internet, then they wouldn't get spoiled. And there could be a coming of age thing. That might be something I do, right? Like a coming of age tradition where they're like at 16. All right, son, you've proven yourself. Here's your first laptop. We might make that a thing. That'd be kind of cool.
But yeah, only maybe that actually, like, because I think another thing, and this is not really tech directly related, but one of the things that we've lost in society, and it is effed us, is coming of age period. In some sort of, like, for men specifically, like a physical challenging way. Like, where I grew up in rural Pennsylvania, you were kind of not a man until you killed your first deer. Like, yeah. Among, like, our peers. That was the thing. Like, and you could be 14. And when I say, I don't mean your dad put you in a tree and you shot a deer. I mean, you went out, you went hunting, you shot a deer, you processed it in the field, you brought it home, you hung it up in the cellar. You, like, at that point, like, they stopped calling you kid, if that makes sense. And I'm not saying everybody needs that. I'm saying we used to have these rites of passage, and they were very regional, very cultural, and they're largely gone. And it was very common, even though they were all different, they were all the same in that kind of conceptual, you know, thing. The Jewish faith, of course, has bar and bar mitzvah, and that's kind of like you're a man or a woman at that point. There's cultures on the African continent where, like, at a certain age, when that kid has a birthday, like, all the men in the village go to the house. And they take the boy away, and the mother's like, they shouldn't be because it's a good thing, but they're kind of afraid because that boy's coming back a man,
mm-hmm.
right? They go out and do some ritual or something, and then they are accepted. And then it's also like now you have not just the recognition of a man, but the responsibility. Yeah. You've gone from being a child that is protected by the community to a man who must defend the community. And maybe there's a technological version of that. That's actually really astute, dude.
I think it's a good idea we're riffing off here. I mean, we need to bring these traditions back. So these kids who seem like hopeless and lost, they have the AI girlfriends, they're completely about pleasure, begin to start thinking about the world as like one holistic unit. So yeah, man, I'm trying to think about what it is. It's like a rite of passage thing. And I think you could say that for the survival skills even. I know, so right now we're in the stage where there is a lot of, I want to come up with a good word. Let's just say like men who have still haven't found their way, right? And there's different projects now that they can go to. There's like the Mankind Project, which is like initiation even after the age you were supposed to get it, which I think are really useful for people. But we just need more of that. And I think a home, you know, even a homeschooling program, like a framework that uses that would be super awesome.
Men in particular are the ones that have really lost it. Like, I don't know if you've ever heard me talk about the thing with the elephants before, but this is a legit mm-hmm. biological thing that they started having these elephants in parts of Africa. These young male elephants would go like rogue and come into communities and like start stomping people and smashing shit and going very violent, like a gang.
Wow.
And the elders were like, I don't understand, because you know they've been around when this never happened,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden it just starts happening. And what had happened is the governments had culled elephants heavily because they didn't want them to overpopulate, because God forbid the elephants, you know, occupy their own biome, and they had over killed old males.
Mm.
They were seen as unnecessary to a healthy population. They killed all the old men. And when the biologists went in and researched this, they found that in a typical year, an elephant herd was not always together. There were times where there were bachelor's herds, like where the old men would take the young males away for a while and bring them back. This is eerie shit when you start thinking about gang activity, right, and how this mm-hmm. plays into it. And when those young male elephants would do shit like start going toward human settlements and all, or any kind of like fighting amongst themselves or anything that they considered unelephant-like, these older big-ass bulls would just beat the shit out of them, like not kill them or something, but just like an old man going, hey, what are you doing, right? And so they had developed the wisdom to know if we go fuck with people, they come fuck with us, so don't do that.
Right.
Well, as soon as that, like, they quit doing these culling patterns the way they were, and, you know, 25 years into it, as you start to have some of these elves who are 20 years old being 40, 45, 50 year old mature males, it all went away.
Mm.
They stopped doing this. And then you look at violent gang activities, right? These kids are very violent, but they're actually, they don't know how to fight. If you look at all the fight footage,
no, it's terrible.
They all look like they're like, I mean, I don't know, like this hitting each other. But yet they're very violent, right? Like, what are you doing? You're drowning or something. Like, but you know, if the other person sucks too, it works.
It's kind of nice because some of them are pretty brutal, like on bathroom floors. So if you're going to get hit like that.
Yeah. But
you make a really good point. And I mean, I want to take it, you expand it past gang activity and what's going on in schools, but kind of like the violence on the street.
Yeah.
Which those guys probably, you know, coming from other country, they probably came from war-torn areas. I'm not excusing any of their behavior. It's condemned and they should be in jail. But from a societal level, like that's probably why it's happening. They weren't raised by men.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some of the shit they pulled today, if we would have pulled that then, you'd have been jerked and not in your ass. And you were not, you're going to wish you didn't do it. Right. Like, and we've lost that. And I think the more we lose that, the worse it is. But it does make me wonder if maybe the same type of approach to technology, like you're saying, like, I don't know, when I was in school, you had to learn math before they let you use a calculator, but then eventually they let you use a calculator. I could have done without the lie that I wouldn't have a calculator everywhere I went, because even back then I was like, but I have one on my watch, right? Like, every kid in the 80s had a Casio calculator watch, right? Like, what do you mean? Why wouldn't I have it? The only reason I don't have it is you took it away. But it's not the kid that has the wisdom. It's supposed to be the adult. And maybe there is kind of like a phasing in of tag to not lose the, what I call the immigrant effect. Like, one of the reasons immigrants come to the United States and they become millionaires so quick is because they come in and they're like, oh my God.
Opportunity.
The opportunity is like, they're in their mind, they're like, oh my God, I really can do anything I want. And the person born here doesn't see it. They don't understand it. There was Zig Ziglar, who was a big-time motivational speaker way back in the day, said he told a story one time. This little girl gets on an airplane. He's sitting in first class, and they had the cockpit open so she can look into the cockpit and look all the way down the plane. And she just looks. She's about 5 years old and just goes, gosh. But every man that walked, every adult that walked on that plane didn't just – it's just getting on a plane. Like, they didn't appreciate, or the comedian said, I'm sitting in a chair in the sky and people are complaining about life. Like, being hit with the amazing reality maybe requires not seeing it all the time.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's basically inversion. It's like almost, like freedom, delayed freedom through current kind of constriction. And it's a parenting thing. This is a parenting conversation, right? Because that's the life that you can help shape. But it makes me change my thoughts a little bit on how I'm going to be working with the kids. Because it seems like, you set them up and give them less resources at the start, right? You know, have them rely on themselves more. And they're really going to blow up. Now, I'm gonna think about this coming to age technology program a little bit more, and I want to send you my thoughts on it. I don't know. I have to sit down on how, you know, what is the right age to get a phone. I got my first laptop when I was 11 years old, and that was probably a bad idea.
It
messed me up. I could have been places now. I still am places. I'm exactly where I need to be, but much to my mom's disappointment, right? It's wasted a lot of time. In fact, I can quantify it. Probably like 7,000-8,000 hours playing video games. My case, I don't play video games anymore. But one, thank you, Linux, because there's no games here. It's been that way for 10 years. But there's kids with like 15,000-20,000 hours, dude. So they say it takes you 10,000 hours to be a master of something. I wasn't good at video games. Fuck no. Like, so imagine if I had that time back, what I would do, Jack. So maybe there's like a program, like a little bit of a technology curriculum for the really impressionable ages.
Yeah, your first video game's an Atari 2600 re-release clone, like I have for my grandkids to play with. But I don't know, in the 80s we played video games, so we went outside after we played video games. Like, if you were playing video games, you had a certain amount of time before you got chores, because you were in the house too long, or like when they would leave you alone is when it was like pouring rain outside or something. Other than that, you know, you just didn't sit around playing games all day. We lived on our bikes back then. That gave her kind of drift in, you know. What information are they gathering on students, though? Like, with all of this surveillance in the school, like, to maybe give people impetus to understand what's going on.
So for every student, everything that they are doing on their laptops is being recorded, right? So there's a lot of different techniques they use. They can pick up which websites they're visiting. And so they have a historical log. They kind of know how much time they're spending on which websites too. So they can get a sense of which students are more focused on schools, which students that aren't. And so it's really interesting that this information is opened up to the teacher. It's also opened up to the IT admins. And then there's also a lot of schools now, because they use Google Chromebooks, are integrating with Google Classroom, right? I think it's like 60% of schools use Google Classroom, and all their work is saved inside it. So they're also able to, and this is more of a Google thing, right? There's things that they don't even let the teachers or schools have, but they're able to see how students are developing their work. Now, where it gets kind of crazy is when it comes to journalism, where forgetting the state now. I wasn't prepared to talk about the story, but I'll just share. There is a school out there which had a journalism program, and they were using the software called Gaggle, and Gaggle started censoring their work. It would literally delete the files. And so this escalated, and the students and the journalism teacher, they would go to the school and be like, what's going on here? And the school got really, really defensive. And eventually...
That's always what not guilty parties do, is get really defensive when you ask them a question, right? Like...
Exactly. They're like, no, we're not watching everything you do. Yeah. We're not censoring you. But then they invited the kids to a meeting, and school's lawyer was there. So it was like a shake. It was like, hey, don't pursue this any further. Anyways, these students were great. I wish I knew their names, but this is a story that I'm still working on. But they took this to court, and it turns out many states have rights for a school journalism, and they can do whatever they want. They can write about whatever they want, and the school doesn't have any say in that. So they won. But right, this is just kind of an example of, like, if your student wants to create an assignment outside of the lines, if it's perceived as going against or not in the box of what they want students to learn, you know, they can shut that off really quickly. And that's a sucky feeling. If you've ever been working on a really hard project and you have a Windows update and it just erases it, it's kind of that, but this is even worse because someone's doing it for you. So, they know what you're working on. They know what websites you're visiting in class. They can lock you down at any time. And they are also seeing what you're doing on social media. If you log into an account on your school computer, these tools will actually track the social media outside of the classroom as well. So they have this really comprehensive picture about your child that you probably don't even have. And what gives them the right to do that is my question. What really gives them the right to do that? So what parents can do today if they want to stop this tracking is, one, give them a laptop that doesn't have all these spy systems on it. There's a mother on our team. She helps us with marketing, and both of her kids have Linux laptops. They have our Above Books. And so they told me a story about the first time. So they noticed, this black looking laptop and a sea of Chromebooks. What is that? Oh, it's my Above Book. And they're like, okay, go to the IT cave. And so they sent him to the IT cave, and there's this nice old lady there. She's like, oh, what is this? It's a Linux laptop. Oh, okay. Let me just save these websites and install this extension. And then boom, he could start using that laptop today. So I don't think a lot of parents or students even realize that they can use an alternative computer in school. That they should start, because if they use a Chromebook, literally everything is being tracked. And if you talk about, well, I never consented to it, well, read the student handbook.
They did.
It's like they don't have any right to privacy once you're in school. So
Is there anything else they can do? I mean, like, it would seem like a simple thing would be, even if you're going to use the school device, don't use it for anything except school.
Like, yes.
But that's maybe hard to discipline a kid to. Like, this is your personal device for all your personal shit. And this is only for schoolwork and nothing else, which, honestly, shouldn't we be teaching kids that anyway? Because if you have, like, a work computer that you're able to take home to do work at home, you shouldn't really be doing personal things on your work computer either. Not even because it's against policy, just because it's stupid. It's very stupid to do personal things on your work computer. Now, if you're me or you and you're CEO of your own world, that's one thing. But if you're an employee, there is no world in which that makes sense.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's a really great idea, right? The Chromebook is used for school. If you're doing homework at home, do it. But in actuality, use a personal device for everything else you need to do. That's why we have Above Book. I'm going to put this on the screen, Jack, if I can. Yep. So this is our privacy laptop. You can look at it on abovephone.com/book. It's also under the shop if you go under laptops, right? So this is a cutting-edge Linux laptop. I use this across all my devices. We basically designed this so it's really, really easy to use. And the goal for us was, hey, here's a Linux laptop that you don't have to use a terminal to use. So you can still get whatever apps that you might want. You'd be surprised at some of the things you can install, but you're not in a terminal. And if you have a young person at home, I mean, this is a great laptop for them. One, because they can customize everything that they want, and it's really fun to see what they create. But two, they'll learn a lot of important technical skills, right, from this laptop, just working with it. That being said, it is still easy to use. We have three different models available. If you want to check this out, it's again, it's abovephone.com/book. We are going to have a Black Friday sale starting at the end of this month. So just sign up to this webinar. If you go here to webinar, abovephone.com/webinar, you'll see that. And I'll send Jack the link too, so it'll be on the show notes.
Cool.
But you'll be the first to get access to the sale, and we'll have special deals if you want to get a phone and a laptop together, maybe a phone for yourself, laptop for your child. There's a lot of ways you can mix it up. But this is what I recommend. And, you know, I've been really happy to hear from some of the young people using our products. There's this young man who is 16 in high school. He was homeschooled, but now his Above phone is his first phone, and he's telling his friends about it. He's raising awareness about the apps that they use and how they're not private. So I love it because it actually activated him to start thinking deeper about the impact of technology in his life. So, you know, I think that's probably a good approach when you are exposing your kid to technology. Don't get something that treats them like they're like an idiot. Give them something that's going to give them the tools to grow and be smarter.
And let them be challenged, right? That's the big thing we don't do with our kids is challenge them. I have one piece of advice for your Above book, because I have one that you guys sent me, and that would be you have this great series of videos on it that tells you how to do everything. Have somebody go back through those videos, amp the volume, reproduce them, and start using them with more volume, because they're like, you have to put headphones on here. They're really, really quiet. They're great videos. They just need a little.
Thanks for that. And, yeah, no, that's good. Whoa.
I mean, they're quiet. They're like, this is something that's just over here. And you're like, I put like a Bluetooth headset on. I'm like, okay, now I know what the hell they're saying. Because it's. I mean, I don't know why everybody doesn't do that with any device, by the way. Like, here's all the things you need to use to use your device. Why do it over and over again? You do it once and put it out there. But yeah, crank that volume up.
Thank you, brother. Yep. And that's the beauty about having a small company like this. We don't want to grow super huge. So when we get good feedback like this, we can act on it right away. So yeah, I really appreciate that, man. And I hope your Linux laptop is working well for you.
It is. I'm talking to you through it right now. yeah, but that would be my one thing. That's a pretty easy one to do too. That's just like whatever your editor is, just shove the volume up and re-render was the word. It wouldn't come to me. Re-render them. What else can students do before we kind of move on to wrapping up here? Or so, parents of students do?
Yeah. So if they do have a Chromebook, and I think this is an interesting idea, if they do have a Chromebook, there is a way. If it's old enough, there is a way to jailbreak it and take off the protection that lets you, you know, usually prevents you from writing to the disk, and you can install a different operating system on it. Now, it's a bit complex, so I'm working on a guide to do this, but I think it's an awesome effort because, you know, we're spending billions of dollars on these Chromebooks. Think about how many Chromebooks are out there. It's like millions upon millions. And so you've got all these Chromebooks flooding the market. What can you really do with these things? If you want to call them weapons, I'll call them weapons. But if you can take them and convert them into tools, that's like the ultimate act of resistance. So I think that's really cool. I'm going to be releasing a guide on this. The digital ID, I was supposed to have more things ready for this, but the damn digital ID report took me so long. Here's advice to anyone. If you do a global analysis, give yourself like 6 months. It's a lot. So anyways, I'm going to be working on this guide to hijack the Chromebook and install a Linux-based operating system on it. There's a few different steps. It's fairly technical. So I'll write that, and maybe if there are kids that you know that are interested, and you know this would let them play games on their computer, right? Maybe you kind of pull them in with that. It would let them do whatever they want on their computer and take it to school as well. Then they could follow this guide. So
I have one. It lives in my shop, and I have a 120-inch drop-down screen projector and all out there for presentations, but we also watch movies and shit. And I just have a Chromebook because that way you can go to Netflix.com and watch stuff or you know, things like that instead of having a cable box out there.
It's a permanent computer.
Yeah. Yeah, but it could be anything. It's just, you know, I needed one out there, and, you know, Chromebook's $300 or less, and you buy one and throw it out there, and it was good to go. We don't do any work with it. But, like, one of the things I learned about it, and I didn't know this, like, you can't install Brave on it. Like, it's the dumbest thing, because Chrome sucks and it has no ad blocking tech. Like, you don't appreciate browsers that have ad blocking technology as to how much, not just about not seeing the ad, how much freaking time it saves you, yep. How much cumbersome bullshit you're not dealing with processing until you can't do it. And you're like, oh my God, I just want to go to this website. Why can't I read anything? And it's because, you know, 27 dancing clouds are trying to get you to redo your mortgage or something, you know. Because
there's sexy new singles in your area.
Yeah, really, like, you know, seniors in Texas aren't supposed to know about this way that they can get nothing. Like, stuff like that. You're like, holy shit, I just, all I want to do is zoom, zoom, zoom. But I can't, zoom, boom, boom, right? Like, that's how it's supposed to feel.
Here's an ad blocker for you.
You can't put Brave. It's an app. I can put it on a Google phone. Why can't I put it? No, you can't, because they don't want you to.
Chromebooks are designed to be locked down, and now everyone has learned that it's like the platform that's really important, right? It's the platform. So they want to force your browser. But hey, I do believe you can install extensions. Take a look at your above books browser extensions, because you probably notice your ads are blocked there. That uBlock Origin, you should be able to get that on your Chromebook, and that'll do the same. It'll kill ads.
Okay.
Yeah. What else?
I haven't, like I said, because I don't do anything with it, I haven't messed with it. But, like, the first thing I do when I get a device is, like, put the stuff I want on it. And, like, I
can't do that.
Brave. And I'm like, well, I know I'm not putting Dissenter on that thing then, because that's never going to happen, right?
Yeah, man.
So do you have any, like final thoughts for people? Again, kind of review, like, what they can find at Above Phone. And, like, you have some of these, like, seminars and things like that coming up. And you have this report that you sent me. Let people know all about that, and I'll make sure they can get it in the show notes.
All right, yeah, for sure. So I've been working on this digital ID report for the last 3 months, probably the biggest project I've done. And I wanted to just raise awareness about what's going on with digital ID and give people a definition to work off of. So when you see this stuff start to become more commonplace, it's really early on, guys. We're like 10 to 15% in. When you see it coming, you'll be able to clearly identify it and you'll be able to work around it, right? Because I think we have about 2 years right now to build very resilient community networks where you can go to this person, look them in the eye and say, hey, whatever we're doing, digital ID will never come between us. I'll never put a digital ID wall between our products. That's what I think everyone needs to be doing now. That's what I'm doing here in my town. That's what you'd be doing in yours. So if you want to understand how digital ID works and what it's going to look like in the future, and I've literally studied every continent, go to abovephone.com/digital. The report is already available for download, and you can download it here. You'll get the report in your email. You'll also get an executive summary. I'll appreciate if you share that around. Another thing is, if you go to abovephone.com/TSP, you'll see here at the bottom, in the middle of the page, Rise Above, our device and ecosystem seminar, which we're just going to give you an overview. Like, Jack and I didn't get to talk too much about the Above Phone today, but if you just want an explainer that just tells you, like, what the hell is going on, this is the one to watch. I'm going to explain to you how big tech is, one, controlling everything that you do on your phone, how your phone is pre-hacked. It's literally hacked before it can get to you. They can install apps on it. They can remove apps from it. So I'm going to look at clear documented cases, right, where it's pre-hacked. Someone already hacked it. And you'll get to understand that. You'll get to know how your phone is used in surveillance. But most importantly, you'll get to see how the Above Phone will actually work. What is life going to look like on a day-to-day? How are you going to still do the things you love? So that's October 29th at 12 p.m. Join me. That's abovephone.com/TSP, and the sign-up is right there.
Very cool, man. Let me hit a few questions and comments on the way out from the audience that I have starred. Nick says, question for later. When does the new Google phone become available at Above Phone?
Yeah, I think he's talking about the Pixel 10. And Google has been, they've kind of done this to everyone, but there's open source components that they'll make to make it easier for people to implement operating systems. They stopped doing that. So it's just taking a little bit longer. I would say you could expect phones in by the end of the year. I can't promise that, but that's what it's looking like. Right now, we have the 9 series, which I really like the 9 series. So if you go on the site, you'll see that the 9 Pro actually has 16 gigabytes of RAM. So it's just as much as a computer. It's super fast. It's what I use right now, and I really like it.
So this is something I wanted to ask you about, because this is one of my concerns with digital ID, and it could end up being digital. It could be any sort of ID requirement. Because of the things that can be done anonymously on the internet, and some of it is pretty bad. I mean, you know, there's good and bad in all things. Or children accessing porn or who knows what. EU specifically, I've heard about this, like where they're saying, like, just to get online, like, you know, you go to get on the internet and it's like a box that says internet. Yeah, you can't, yeah. Like, right now, we're kind of accustomed to. If I come to your house and I say, hey, do you have a guest network? Yeah, what's the password? 1234, whatever. I jump on your network. I just start doing shit. It seems like each session could be like you can't get on the net without ID. Do you think that's a real risk? And if so, would there be anything we could do about that?
It's possible. It's possible that this can happen in countries where this is kind of already the case in some way or another. It's China. China's like this. India's like this. Pakistan's like this. So Eastern countries, right? The only way it would work is if they have enough compliance from enough of the population. Otherwise, if they did this and people didn't comply, it would crush the economy. Think about it. Like, internet's involved in everything. So they're playing on a slippery slope. They want you to comply, but they can't do everything at once. Yeah. That's why they delayed Real ID for 20 years. They've been doing that for 20 years, hoping people will play along. That's why it's really important to spread the word and stay strong here. To respond to the question too, right, you'll need your digital ID to access the internet and access your Bitcoin. Access your Bitcoin only if you use a big tech device. I can see it being really, really easy when digital ID becomes like there's a national program. It's literally rolled right into your operating system. It's part of it, right? That's another reason why using these de-Googled phones and Linux laptops is so important, to just sidestep that completely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, making you register your car to drive it on the road. Like, the road's there, but imagine if when you went to leave your house, if your vehicle wasn't registered, it wouldn't start. Yeah. Or it would start, but when you put it in gear, it would stay in park. Like that. Yeah. That's kind of what they, because the internet's like this highway system, right? And once you're on it, you can go anywhere and do anything. I think it might be difficult in the United States too, just because you have to get ISPs to comply, and for at least unless you get them all to do it on the same day, well, then everybody's migrating. I mean, right now where I live, that might be a little difficult. You pretty much have Comcast, or you don't have internet here. Except, well, you could have Starlink and you could have dish-based internet, like other, you know, other satellite internet providers. But there's places where, like, where my kid lives, you know, 30 minutes from me, they have like 10 different options for internet service. So it seems a little more difficult. I also think that, like, the whole Bitcoin thing, if I can get on the internet anywhere in any way, I can make that
use Bitcoin.
The problem for Bitcoin and any digital asset, honestly, is less about being able to get on the internet to access it. If you want to spend it, you can do that. That's very difficult to stop.
Cash out.
Cashing out. The on-ramps and off-ramps into and out of fiat are the regulatory bottlenecks where they could make life very, very difficult. Like, mostly I hold just Bitcoin. That's kind of my thing. But I do have a bunch of Ethereum. That I'm not selling because the cost to me to sell it is extreme. It's like 100% income. I bought it when it was a dollar something.
Wow. Right.
So, but if I decided, like, I want to buy another house, the bank is not going to take Ethereum. I would have to, like, I want to buy another house and I want, you know, a down payment for it or whatever. I'm going to have to go through an exchange that allows conversion to cash and out to my bank. And that is the weak spot for the digital asset space.
Yep, that's where the, you know, automatic IRS reporting comes in. That's where the KYC comes in. There are solutions, though, and this is in the report. But let me bring this up. There's this thing called Reto Swap, which I know, Jack, you're familiar with Monero. It's primarily based on Monero. So I brought it up on screen here. And so if you get your cryptocurrency and exchange it into Monero, it's basically this peer-to-peer platform where people will pay out to your new bank, you know, PayPal. There's a bunch of different things that they'll pay out with. Hold on, it's somewhere on here. And well, it actually works.
Selling it to an individual who's paying you in fiat.
Yeah, and they'll pay you, exactly. They'll pay you in Cash App. They'll even mail cash to your house.
Okay.
I've heard that that works. So, and I've heard very good things about the platform. It's also using Tor, if that means the things to anyone. It's pretty private as it goes, but it is based on Monero because Monero is, you know, the one cryptocurrency that's big enough and private by default. So that's Reto Swap. It's also in the report, but this is one worth checking out and testing.
Okay. And that might work for something. I mean, like, I'm not even trying to avoid the IRS here. Mm-hmm. I bought this. If you think about the timeline for it to be that cheap, I bought it on Coinbase because back in the day, that's what everybody used. And you know, Ethereum is an account-based crypto. So, like, there's one address that it all sits on. So I'm not getting away with that anyway. But the point is the bank won't take it. So even if I'm willing to pay the tax on it, I have to convert it before I can spend it in that kind of, like, again, like a house purchase or a car or something, like purchase. Like, that's where they're going to come after us, I think, more than any place else, is the on-off rails.
Have you seen that Craigslist has an option for accepts cryptocurrency? You could buy a car with it. The guys that do it are complete.
Yeah.
The cars they're trying to sell. But, like, I feel like you could pitch someone, you know?
Yeah.
But, no, you're right. That's the major challenge, and that's why these, you know, these peer-to-peer marketplaces are important.
When I bought my boat, I couldn't get the dude. I'm like, it'd be so much easier. He wouldn't do it. Josh says, everyone with a smartphone has an infinite number of infrared photos taken of them and their environment every day. We are all digitally captured already. I think you're both right. Like, your thing is, but there's a difference between it being officially in – you know, and the human component. But I think there is a point where if you really want to do this as a government, you can.
If you can't, you'd have to create a bunch of legislation around it, and it'd be really, really crazy. It would be the government saying, hey, guys, what you're referring to is you're referring to the Face ID features of iPhones, right? I'm not sure if Google's works the same way. I don't think it does, but iPhone has an infrared point cloud of like 30,000 so that it sends out. Again, not happening with above phone. And also when people have iPhones, I say, don't point that at my face. Don't point it at me.
Yeah. The other thing with the iPhone is if you have one and you're using one, turn off the face lock on and off. Not because the phone can't still capture your image. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is a cop taking your phone from you and going and pointing it at your face, and now your phone's unlocked, right? I mean, that, like, fingerprint and facial lock unlock on your phone. I know you feel like freaking, you know, Jason Bourne or James Bond or some shit because you can open it with your finger. And, I mean, I use on one of my computers has a fingerprint thing, and if for convenience I'll use that. But you're not getting anything off of that computer anyway. Your phone is with you all the freaking time. And any lawyer will tell you, shut. Like, if a cop stops you, things like, can I have your license and registration? Give that to them. Where are you coming from? You don't really need to know that. Don't talk. Because you don't know what you don't know. And you can place yourself in a place you had nothing to do with what went on, but maybe you look like the guy they're looking for, and they're looking to place you in that place. So keep your mouth shut. Your phone knows a lot more shit than you can remember. And so if you let a cop unlock your phone, and they will freaking do it, and they'll lie. They'll say, I picked this phone up and it was unlocked. I didn't know that I ran it by his face or whatever, right? and then that phone will tell them everything they want to know.
Yeah.
And if you're using an iPhone, by the way, the cop probably is too, and he knows how it works. I mean,
He knows how it works. Yeah, I mean, they get trained on this. They also have technology that, like, I mean, this is happening at the borders now, Jack. Like, you've probably heard, right? They're asking people from overseas, hey, can I see your phone? And they take it into a back room. Well, they have technology that it's called FDE, full data extraction. And it's technology that's, like, literally built to pull data off and recreate it. It's an Israeli company called Cellebrite that does it. They're one of the major players.
And guess what? It's an Israeli company. Of course it is.
Of course.
Of course it is. Yeah.
So iPhones are susceptible. Samsungs are susceptible. Even Google Pixels are susceptible. But the above phone, Google Pixel with Graphene OS, is not on their list of devices that they support. And they would love to put it on the list of devices because every time they do, it becomes more attractive to law enforcement. They get millions of dollars. So this is a phone they literally can get their hands on. And what Jack is saying is totally right, right? If you enroll your fingerprint into this, they'll take your hand, put it on it. But if you're not doing that, this is one phone that they can't break into. So it's definitely worth looking into.
I've always thought we should, you know, like some of the Bitcoin wallets, like Zeus, I use Zeus in my own node, has what's called a duress pin.
Right?
Maybe we should build in the phone some sort of a duress pin that literally creates a fake, like they think they're in. It's one thing to like lock it up permanently or whatever. It'd be another thing if they're like, oh, this guy's fucking boring. He doesn't do anything, right? Like, maybe that's something we need, is some sort of duress pin. Like, you enter this alternative pin, or you even give it to them. What's your pin number? 17115, whatever, you know, just some bullshit number you have to also remember. But when they enter that number, then they're like,
yeah,
bro doesn't make shit for phone calls. He doesn't do anything, right? You know, like,
I'm glad you brought that up.
Work, you know, then.
Yeah, I mean, and then they're off the trail. They're off the scent, which is a scary thing. I mean, Jack, I don't know if you've seen those videos of people getting assaulted. They've been targeted and assaulted for their crypto. It's brutal, man. It's brutal. Yeah. And so that's what they're looking for, too. On this phone, you can actually create private spaces. It's like it's kind of a hidden space. If you don't know it's there, you can't activate it. But it's a private space where you can put your crypto app, your financial app. So you look at it, it looks like a normal phone. There's also user profiles, which are separate, different containers that looks like having a phone within your phone that you can kind of use. You need to know ahead of time someone's getting your phone to turn those on. But the private space is great because it'll just kind of be there by default and it won't show up on your phone. One last thing is that there is a duress pin. And if you enable this, which I've had a customer or two that's like, I accidentally put in my duress pin. Everything's gone. And we're like, yep, that's the point. That's the point of the duress pin.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just deletes everything.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like, it'd be better if it just created that compartmentalization so that you don't actually lose it, but they don't see it. Then I want to ask you about this and then we can wrap up. I just, when you were talking at some point, I thought of this about protests. So Jack Dorsey was talking about this app. I can't remember what it's called now, but it basically allows text messaging using Bluetooth, which at first I was like, so that's about 30 feet. That's stupid. But then again, I have like this repeater up on my thing for Bluetooth messaging that actually can go pretty damn far using Bluetooth on a rebroadcast. But then I realized what he was actually pushing it for. Like, they'll shut off internet in an area. Like, they'll shut off the cell access where a protest is going on or whatever. But if you have Bluetooth, then the people can communicate with each other. It's really device to device, right? And if you're using it like in a group chat, then it's device to device to device to device. Like, once this device has it, then all the devices in its range have it, and then all the devices in that. And that's really impossible to stop. What are your thoughts on that? I can't remember the name of the app, but it's something.
It's called BitChat, or you could call it BitChat.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of research on this one. And one thing that's interesting, Jack, supposedly, he says this, he built it over a weekend with AI. Yeah. He built it over a weekend. So that's the first thing. And I think that's pretty important. But it's not the first app to do this. It's just the first app to kind of do it really like well and streamlined and get a lot of public attention. Before BitChat, there was Briar, which aims to do the same thing. And then it's like what you're saying, like the when you would use it, exactly. It's like you would use it in kind of like a grid down or internet shutdown scenario, which Pakistan goes through like every few months that they do this to their people. So it could be really useful. The thing is that everyone needs to have it installed ahead of time. So I think you could go to what is it, like BitChat? You can. Oh, actually, I should be careful. Let me get you the official link, because when he released it, there's so many fake versions of this that are trying. Briar, it's just malware.
Well, you see. Will absolutely slaughter your battery.
Yeah, right. That's like having the Bluetooth on. So your Bluetooth will be running. And I think it's really good. Just enough people need to have it. I don't see myself going to a protest. So not like that anyways. So I don't really care for it. What I'm hoping for is a long range radio. That's like kind of the next phase of what we want to do.
I'll send you some info on that. That's what I have out here. Mm-hmm. There is a radio tech that you're Bluetooth to the repeater, but the repeater is using radio frequency to transfer the information and relay it.
Nice.
I have it on your phone and your laptop. I'll send you a link to the episode where we talked about it.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. No. I mean, I think these are important. I think, like I said, with digital ID, 2 years away from digital ID being available, give it another 3 years. That's when we're getting into the stick phase. Really, we could see them saying, hey, you need it to use the internet. You want to make sure you have a mesh network or something like this before that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and KT says Meshtastic, that's what it's called. It was just the brain cell that word was in was not accessible at the moment when I was talking about it. And I think the digital ID thing, like, we're being trained for that right now. Like, 90% of people, when they go through line to get on an airplane, they're picking their phone up with a QR code. They don't have a paper ticket anymore. A lot of event venues, like for concerts and shit, they're like, you know, put this in your Apple wallet. And if you don't have one, do a screenshot of it. And so even if you're using it as just a picture and you're not using Apple wallet or the Google equivalent or whatever, you're still using they're conditioning you to take a device.
They don't even scan the device
to get into a place.
They don't even let you take a picture or download anymore. You know, it has to be in the app. But what I've found is you just go to the ticket office in person, and then they pretend like you're a maniac for buying a paper ticket, but they'll print you out one. Yeah, it's crazy. But you're right. You bring up a good point, is that they're training you to do that at the airport. You also probably have seen, Jack, if you've gone to the big cities, like the little gates in grocery stores now, you know, the little security gates.
Yeah.
What do you think? It's perfect. Just wait for the digital ID terminal. It's happening. These things take time.
This shit is old, bro. When I was in data cabling back in the 90s in sales, I had a contract with a company called Gymboree. I don't know if you, they sell like kids' clothes and shit like that. And we had these sensors. This is the 90s that were up above the doorway when you went in. And it was pretty benign what they were doing, but it just tells you what could be done even back then. There was a certain standard of pixels that went down. And that way, if you had just put a laser beam across and two people walked in at the same time, then you didn't have an exact count of the people coming in. But by doing it from above and disturbing the pixels, you were able to determine three people walked in, not one. And they were keeping in, like, how many people went in and out of their store every day and what times. And it was all about merchandising management is what they were doing. But if you could do that in 1990, that was about 1998, I got that contract for my company. That's almost 30 freaking years. Dude, that's crazy.
No, it's crazy. It's crazy, and it all comes through being data-driven. I don't know what they do nowadays, but I mean, like, you know, you've probably heard that story about Target, how they were predicting people, how they were predicting girls were pregnant before they even knew they were pregnant based on what they were buying.
Yeah, I heard
Amazon cashless.
Yeah, you remember that? Okay, we know that you're, and they weren't buying like pacifiers and shit. It was just like when certain hormonal changes begin in the human female body before she's even aware she's pregnant, she starts changing her behavior. That's yeah, that, and that's shit, isn't it?
It's crazy. But so it's like when I studied predictive analytics and machine learning, like that's what they told us. It's not about finding the reasons for the data. It's just about seeing the data and knowing that, you know, the human reasons come later. The data comes first. That's why they collect as much of it as they possibly mm-hmm. can. Then they can figure out later. It's like, all right, this person's probably pregnant. We can market to them later on. And it was really funny because I remember that story, like her father answered the door and they were like, oh, is she home? We want to talk to her about her pregnancy. And so it was a major shock to that family.
Wow.
Not the best way to get outed.
Well, folks, hope you guys enjoyed today. We ran past the 2-hour mark, so it had to be a good discussion or it wouldn't have went that long. Hakeem, I'd like to thank you for being with us today. And again, just remind people of where they can learn more about your work.
Yes, thanks everyone for watching. Follow my work. If you want to watch my weekly show, go to tbot.substack.com. I do a weekly show about the most important news stories every week. Every week I have a solution because I'm not about being a doom porner. I want people to feel inspired. So check that out. That's tbot.substack.com. Also, join our webinar coming up next Wednesday. Go to abovephone.com/TSP. If you want to learn more about the Above Phone, I would love to see you there. And you'll see the information to sign up for that and the report on that page.
Awesome, man. I appreciate you for being with us today.
Thank you, Jack, for having me on. Blessings.
All right, folks, real quick, thanks for being with us today. I just want to go ahead and wrap up with you here at the end. First and foremost, I want to remind you guys, one of the ways you can help support our work is to always start your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Go there. You'll see all the things that I've reviewed over the years. There's over 500 products reviewed there. They're all things I've spent my own money on, or I wouldn't recommend them to you. Today's item of the day is low-tech, high-tech, right? The Thermal Maven Instant Read Meat Thermometer. You need one of these if you're a cook at all. If you microwave your food, that's different. If you cook steaks and pork chops and stuff like that, I'm all about the high-tech, Bluetooth-enabled probes and all. They don't work for certain things, and they're just not right for certain things. An instant read is exactly what it says. It's instant read. This is the best one I can find without mortgaging a kidney. They cost about $20. You open them up like you open up a folding knife, stick it in, gives you a number. They use a regular freaking battery. It's either AA or AAA. I don't remember. I think there are two AAAs in it. So you don't need some kind of space age battery for the damn thing. And a lot of them that use like the little disc batteries we use for like our scopes and stuff like that. Yeah, I have those batteries, but they're impossible to close. This thing, you take a screw off, pop, like it just works. And it's accurate as get out. Got one of these for my son as well so he can make sure that his wife's steak isn't too red or whatever. These are fantastic, and again, they're about $20. It will improve your cooking, and it opens beer bottles. So that's got enough, and it's magnetic, and it's got one of the most important things that these things can have, an automatic shutoff, so that when you leave it open, because you will, it doesn't kill the battery on you, because you will, and because it will. Next up today, I just want to remind you guys, as always, about my book, Laws of Life. Ditch the System, Design Your Life by Jack Spirko. You can pick up a copy on Amazon. Pick it up, give it as a gift, read it, improve your life with it. I've had almost nothing but great feedback. We'll talk about a particular Karen in the future. I won't bore you with that right now toward the end after this long of a show. Again, thanks for tuning in. Pick up a copy of the book. Shop at T-Spaz. Check out Above Phone's website, or Above Agency's, I should say, website, and check out all of the cool stuff. I will have, as Hakeem mentioned and I mentioned during the show, I will have everything in the show notes. Right down, if you're in watching the video, there's a link right near the top of the video notes below. You click that link, you go over to the audio side, you get all of the stuff. If you're watching me live and you click that link right now, it won't work because I'm not quite done yet. It'll take about 30 minutes after the live stream ends for the audio version to go up. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with that expert panel Q&A show of the week. Just run you round. Face the truth.
lady should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.